Christians should operate fully in the public square, and that includes by engaging with the media.
Molly Hemingway talking about her joint presentation at the 2017 Fall Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
And one of the things that they can do is encourage reporters to report things accurately and truthfully. They can express their opinions in letters to the editor and op-eds. And one of the things that's important is to just let people in the world know of the differences of opinion that are out there, that Christians don't share a lot of the secular thinking that is promulgated by the media. And so being bold and being able to stand up and simply speak truth in the public square, it's a powerful witness to others, and it's a service you can perform for your community and the country at large.
You can meet and hear Molly and Mark Hemingway making the case for Christians engaging the news media at our Fall Making the Case Conference, November 10th and 11th in Houston, Texas. Learn more at issuesetc.org.
Creating a genderless marriage institution would have to break down the connection between parenthood and biology.
But as I was growing up, how often did I hear marriage preached about in any substantial way? Not often, and that's probably due to the divorce culture that made us probably quiet about teaching what marriage is and why it matters.
If the Lord could save Peter, who denied his Lord three times, then he can save you. If the Lord can save that one who persecuted the very church of God and Christ himself, consenting to the martyrdom of his saints, then he can save you.
When driving to and from work through the Las Vegas Valley and den of iniquity, I always hit the jackpot by listening to Issues, Etc.
When I first read this headline from the Salt Lake Tribune, I thought I had misread the headline. Extramarital sex higher among older Americans than younger counterparts, University of Utah study finds. And I started reading the story. And I thought, okay, maybe I can explain this. Because this probably just has to do with a survey as to, you know, have you ever had extramarital sex? And of course, the older people with more life experience are going to say yes at a higher rate than the younger people probably. But that's not what it is. It actually is that in the last year, one in five Americans older than 55 say that they've engaged in extramarital sex in the last year, not in their lifetimes, but in the last year. And that's more than their younger counterparts. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in live on this Friday afternoon, the 7th of July. We're going to be talking about that study with Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse of the Ruth Institute. Then progressivism and religion will be the subject with Alexandra DeSanctis of National Review Institute. And we'll round everything off on this Friday afternoon in the last half hour or so, playing Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week, that simple game we like to play with our listeners, where we play four soundbites from this week's Issues Etc. audio. You listen, and then you give us a call, 1-877-623-6943. Send us an email, talkback at issuesetc.org, a tweet at issuesetc, or go to our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc, and vote for one of those to be Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. Joining us on this Friday to talk about a new study on extramarital sex among older Americans, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse, founder and president of the Ruth Institute. Jen taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason Universities. She's author of several books, including her latest, The Sexual Revolution and Its Victims. And we're going to be talking about this new study on extramarital sex among older Americans. It's kind of cringeworthy, Jennifer, to bring up this subject. I'm wondering, we worry so often about the younger generation and this subject. Have we had too narrow a focus on the population, this segment of the population, as to the effects of the sexual revolution?
Well, you know, we need to be concerned about everyone. You know, when the subject is sin and going outside of God's plan for human sexuality, of course, we have to be concerned about every single soul. But yes, I do think that the baby boomer generation, which is my generation, and I think approximately yours too, Todd, if I'm not mistaken.
Absolutely.
We have kind of run out of sins to do more of, you know. We're kind of taking the cake in a lot of these areas. And I think that a lot of people in our generation entered into their adult lives with a set of ideas that were profoundly skewed. And the people who have stopped and reconsidered those ideas, you know, have straightened themselves up. I hope I've straightened myself up. Actually, I hope I live long enough to do penance for all my sins. But the people who haven't gotten over what they decided in college, you know, who haven't rethought their basic commitments since they graduated from college, those people are still, you know, doing crazy things. And I think that's part of what you're seeing here in these data that were just reported by the University of Utah study.
So I take it doesn't surprise you particularly.
Well, you know, kind of nothing surprises me anymore. I mean, I guess I was a little surprised when I looked closely at this study. And by the way, on the Ruth Institute Facebook page, I put a link not just to the Salt Lake Tribune article, but also the study from the Institute for Family Studies that it was based on. So if you look at that and you look at some of the numbers, one thing that did kind of surprise me is that most generations are less disapproving of adultery now than they used to be. You know, if you compare 2016 with 1990 or something like that, you'll see that for the most part, people are more tolerant of adultery and more tolerant of ethical non-monogamy, as it's now called, except for some of the younger generations. So I thought that was quite interesting. But other than that, Todd, I tell you, it takes a lot to surprise me these days.
One of the things I got to thinking about this after I read the story was, you know, in these kind of surveys, I think we have to assume in looking at the results that it at least in part is underreporting, because I'm not necessarily sure that the average person wants to admit to on a survey that they've had extramarital sex in the last year. There might be a lot of reasons not to admit that. So should we assume that the numbers might be ever so slightly even higher than they're being reported?
I think that's probably a safe assumption. And in this area of research, Todd, that's something people have always been sensitive to, you know, is whether people are withholding accurate information. And so modern survey techniques include ways of assuring the person's anonymity. You know, you fill out the survey online or over the phone or those type of things to make it more likely that the person will give truthful answers. But even so, I think it's interesting that in spite of the best efforts of the sexual revolutionaries to wipe out all of our sense of shame, people do feel some shame about these issues. I mean, I think there's a law of nature written on the heart, as our friend St. Paul would say, right? That no matter what is going on Playboy magazine or on MTV, people still have a residual sense that there's something wrong with certain kinds of sexual activities, and so they don't want to report it. You know, they don't just come out and say, "Yeah, by golly, I messed around with my next door neighbor five times while my husband was on business." You know, people don't really mean it when they say that they're moral relativists. You know, when it gets right down to it, nobody wants to admit to a thing like that.
So is this, I guess what I'm wondering is, because you talked earlier about how some people have left all their presuppositions unexamined since they graduated from college. Is this just a holdover in our particular generation, the baby boomers, from a promiscuous past, and they're kind of, you know, what do they call it, a midlife crisis, trying to recapture their youth by fooling around a little bit? Or is there something more to this in terms of the sexual revolution?
Boy, that's an interesting question. You know, there are a lot of complicated psychological dynamics that go into, you know, giving a full answer to the question of people's thought process. I read a very interesting article the other day on Crisis Magazine that was talking about the opiate problem nobody wants to talk about, nobody really wants to solve. And what the author was saying was that people have the idea that they're supposed to be happy all the time, and if they don't feel happy all the time, then you need some type of substance or activity to give yourself a little chemical buzz. But what the author pointed out is what Christians have known all along, you know, since the very beginning, which is that the natural state of man is original sin. And nothing can really make us happy in the most lasting sense of happy other than a relationship, a saving relationship with Jesus Christ. That's what's going to make you happy. A lot of things will give you pleasure, give you a little endorphin rush or something, but the only thing that's going to give you lasting happiness of the sort that even the Greek philosophers were aware existed is that saving relationship with Jesus Christ. And so the point of the person's article there was to say, you know, a lot of our cultural leaders don't want to deal with that fact. You know, they don't want to deal with the idea that you need Christ in order to be truly happy and truly satisfied. And if you have him, you can be happy in a concentration camp. And if you don't have him, you can be snorting all kind of stuff up your nose and you're still not going to be happy. You know, so there are many of our opinion leaders and social leaders and so on who just don't want to deal with that. And I think that is part of what we're seeing here. You know, the de-Christianization of our culture has meant that a lot of people end up in their middle age or older with a profound sense of emptiness that they don't know what to do with.
The piece from the Salt Lake Tribune quotes the researcher who headed up the study, Nicholas Wolfinger. And this is another facet of this that I'd like you to address near the end of the story. He says, even as overall divorce rates have fallen in recent decades, there has also been a startling surge in quote-unquote gray divorce among the middle-aged. Are the two issues related?
Isn't that interesting? I found that to be quite fascinating as well. You know, overall divorce rates are falling, but there's an increase in divorce of those in the, you know, older, of the older generations. One reason for the first part of that paradox, Todd, is that people at younger ages are simply not getting married in as great a rate. So people are cohabiting rather than getting married. When those relationships dissolve, as they do, and they do quite more frequently than an actual marriage would dissolve, when those relationships dissolve, they don't count as part of the divorce rate because it was never marriage there in the first place. So that's a little bit of a statistical artifact there that's making it look, you know, maybe like things are better than they really are in the sense of permanence. And if you look at it from the child's perspective, of course, what the child cares about is the permanence and stability of the relationship of their parents. That's what children care about. What is the stability of my parents' union? That's what they care about. And so even if you're in your 30s and your parents are in their, you know, early 60s and they get divorced, it still has an impact on children of all ages. And that, I think, is the thing that people refuse to face, is that divorce continues to be harmful to children, no matter how old those adult children may be.
Somewhere in all of this, I'm sure there's something related to Alfred Kinsey. Introduce our audience to him very briefly. And what do you think how would his claims have matched up with what we just have recently learned about adultery in older adults?
Well, I'll tell you something. Alfred Kinsey, I'm sure a lot of you have very sophisticated listeners, so I'm sure most of them are aware that he's the guy who wrote the book called Sexuality in the Human Male, Sexuality in the Human Female. Back in the 40s and early 50s, he wrote those two books. And when the American GIs came back from World War II, they were greeted with the news that approximately one-third of American married men had at one time or another been unfaithful to their wives, right? And that was one of Kinsey's so-called scientific results. Well, this data that we have here from, you know, the day before yesterday and 50 years of the sexual revolution, even today, you don't have a single age cohort where you have 30% or a third of the population of married men having sex with somebody other than their wives. You know, so his numbers back in the day were inflated, and badly inflated. He was criticized by the American Statistical Association and so on because his numbers were not representative of the population. But what his numbers did was to convince people that everybody else was doing it, and you were a chump if you hung on to traditional Christian morality. That was the social significance of Kinsey. And I think the people who promoted him and who publicized him, I think they knew exactly what they were doing. And in fact, the organization that financed Kinsey's research was the Rockefeller Foundation. And, you know, without the Rockefeller Foundation, nobody would have ever heard of Alfred Kinsey. He would be a two-bit bug doctor with a personal masturbation problem, and nobody would have ever heard of the man. But because of the Rockefeller Foundation and all of the attention that they were able to give his work, everybody knew that, you know, 10% of the population was gay and 35% of the population had been cheating on their wives and so on and so forth. And so everybody felt like, maybe Christian morality is old-fashioned and out of date, and I better get with the program.
So I'm not saying there's a silver lining to this cloud, but this does help disprove Kinsey's claims, at least in our modern context, doesn't it?
Oh, it sure does. And you know, his most extravagant claims, none of them have ever been substantiated. You know, the 10% of the population is gay number, that went away a long time ago. Nobody's ever come close to replicating that number. And the same with this number here, too. So unfortunately, though, the damage has been done, and people like your listeners need to be more proactive about sharing this type of information, because, you know, the cultural soup that we're all swimming in has just been infected with this concept that everybody's doing it. Well, we now know this data, and, you know, another story you had me on about a couple of weeks ago, you know, the younger people are actually having sex less frequently, or smaller percentages of young kids today are having sex than previous generations of young kids did, you know. So it's not all doom and gloom, but we never hear that because the powers that be want everybody to think that nobody can control themselves.
Finally, another quote here from the story, and this again from the study's author, Nicholas Wolfinger, where he says this, and I just want to see if you might quibble with the way he phrases this. He says, "The seeds sown by the sexual revolution continue to bear unanticipated fruit among older Americans." He makes it sound like the sexual revolution was something in the past that sowed its seeds long ago. It's still alive and well, isn't it?
Well, that's right. That's right. And I find when I use this term, the sexual revolution, that a lot of people think that's something that happened at Woodstock and it's been over. But the fact is, in order to keep something like these principles alive, you have to continually promote and pump and keep pushing forward with the revolution, because the whole thing's irrational. You know, you can't build a whole society around the idea that sex doesn't make babies. And so in order to build a society like that, you just have to keep doing more and more bizarre things to bolster that belief system. So it's a kind of permanent revolution. In fact, when I was at Acton Institute a couple of weeks ago, somebody used that phrase to me. Somebody said, "This, Dr. Morse, this sounds like what Trotsky would have called the permanent revolution." And I think that's right. You know, it's a continuous state of permanent revolution. And it's very much like the ideologies of the 20th century. The sexual revolution is you could think of it as another deadly ideology of the 20th century, which has some things in common with communism and some things in common with fascism. But what they all have in common is a core idea that is irrational and that requires a massive amount of force and propaganda to sustain. And that's why they become totalitarian movements.
Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse is founder and president of the Ruth Institute. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason Universities. She is author of several books, including her latest, The Sexual Revolution and Its Victims. She'll also be speaking at the 2017 Fall Issues, Etc. Making the Case Conference, November 10th and 11th in Houston, Texas. Her topic, Making the Case Against the Sexual Revolution. You can find out more and register at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. The Fall Issues, Etc. Making the Case Conference, November 10th and 11th in Houston, Texas. Jen, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. And I'm really looking forward to that conference. Talk to you soon.
When we come back, we're going to spend some time talking about religion and progressivism. There is a deepening sense, a dawning sense, in progressive political circles, probably centered in the Democratic Party, that they need to recapture the religious vote. But is there a clash between their basic philosophy and religion? We'll talk about that with Alexandra DeSanctis of the National Review Institute after this.
Memoria Press invites all Issues Etc. listeners to explore our Simply Classical curriculum, a set of full-year academic curriculum packages for children with learning challenges. Our classical writing program and our Christian studies are now based on your favorite CPH Bible storybooks. To learn more, visit classicalspecialneeds.com and use promo code LPR to save on your initial purchase. That's classicalspecialneeds.com.
Are you tired of working nights, weekends, and odd hours trying to cover your bases at home just to make ends meet? At the Cleaning Authority, we call that the multi-job shuffle, and we want to end that for you right now. We'll train you in our proven, efficient cleaning methods, and you'll be partnered to work in pre-qualified homes. Call 314-416-8117 and walk away from the multi-job shuffle with a future in our St. Louis office. 314-416-8117.
Solid. Serious. Substantive. You're listening to Issues Etc.
If you've ever attended an Issues Etc. conference or any number of events that take place across the Senate and have wondered why more people from my congregation aren't here, check out the special seminar package the CLCC is offering for the 500th anniversary. All you need so the pastors of your circuit can organize, promote, and present a seminar that appeals to the members of your congregation, even the youth, is provided free by the CLCC. Just go to theclcc.org and click on the blue box, or check us out on Facebook.
An average of 20 military veterans kill themselves every day. Project Operation Barnabas is a network of LCMS congregations who reach out to veterans and their congregations and their communities with the gospel of Jesus Christ. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armedforces. Serving those who serve. LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. lcms.org/armedforces.